WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On Halloween, it's common to indulge yourself in thinking about the supernatural. My guest, Anne Rice, thinks about the supernatural most of the year. She wrote contemporary vampire stories in her best-selling Vampire Chronicles. The vampire Lestat was about one of the undead who had such dark charisma he became a rock star. Rice turns to witchcraft in her new novel, The Witching Hour. If this isn't enough to convince you that she leads a pretty wild fantasy life, I should tell you she's also written contemporary erotic fiction under the pen name Anne Rampling, and a series of pornographic novels under the name A.N. Roquelar. Her new novel, The Witching Hour, is about a neurosurgeon who discovers she's descended from a long line of witches. I wanted to know why Rice turned to the subject of witches.
All I can say is an idea for a book came into my mind. It took over. The book began to take shape. It was about this spirit lasher, this discarnate entity, who had become the familiar and the lover of these witches. And the whole thing simply began to take on its own life. It wasn't a conscious decision. You know, it wasn't saying, I'd like to branch out. I mean, that's true. I would. And I do feel that way. And I want to write all kinds of supernatural novels. I want to write a great haunting novel. I want to write a novel in the Frankenstein tradition, that type of thing. But the decisions really aren't made in that logical or rational way.
Can you describe a little bit what the witches are like in your book? What makes them witches? What special powers they have?
In my book, witches are people who can attract and manipulate unseen forces. They can do things to matter. They can make things happen that other people can't make happen. They have a sort of psychic energy. And they particularly can draw these discarnate spirits and cause these spirits to fall in love with them and do what they want.
And can these powers be used for good and evil?
Oh, absolutely. Just as any human being can use his or her powers for good or evil.
Vampires exist in horror fiction and in movies, but there are a lot of people today who think of themselves as practicing witches. It's not only part of the occult, but there's even a branch of feminist paganism that feels very connected to witchcraft. Do you have any connection to that or any interest in it?
No, I really don't. What interested me in the book were these women as outcasts. They have unusual powers. They have a great deal of imagination. They know things other people don't know. That's probably true today of the women who are interested in Wicca or witchcraft now. For me, what's more interesting is the fact that it's a metaphor for everyone's exceptional powers. I mean, you can read The Witching Hour as being about women with great imagination or great creative power. You can read it as being about women with great sexual drives that perhaps set them apart from the other women around them. The great thing about supernatural fiction is that all those metaphors are there. If you give your whole heart to it as a writer, it's an endless well of meaning, really.
Did you ever have an experience that you could only attribute to the supernatural that was either like mystical or psychic?
No, I've actually had none. But I'll tell you, I'm very afraid of the dark. I'm very afraid of being alone. I've felt all my life that there's something there, and I think I shut it out. I think I consciously shut it out because the evidence, the written scholarly evidence for apparitions, for ghosts, for something out there that we can't explain is really rather overwhelming, and I think it scares me.
So you believe that that's a possibility?
Oh, definitely. I really do. I'm not close-minded on any of that. The more I read in the occult, the more I'm fascinated by what ordinary people have experienced with mediums, communicating with the dead, in their near-death experiences. We have a lot of books on that today. In past life, regression, things like this. I'm fascinated. I'm open-minded.
Now, early in your life, I think you were part of the Catholic Church, and I think your mother used to be fairly religious. Is there any connection to the imagery of the church and the imagery of vampire and witches as you use them in your books?
Oh, I think so. I really do. the spiritual realm is an absolute reality to anyone who's a Catholic. You grow up believing that what's invisible and spiritual is infinitely more important than what's material and real around you. And though I lost my faith in God very early and my faith in the church very early, there remained a sort of spiritual urgency, a kind of religious approach, as it were, to writing and to seeking answers about life. And it was only when I started to write Interview with a Vampire, you know, a book about a vampire from his point of view, that I was able to talk about all that, about good and evil, about grief over the loss of faith, that kind of thing. I use that supernatural character to speak in those spiritual terms, and it's not surprising to me that an ex-Catholic would do that, you know. I mean, when you grow up believing in saints, and you grow up talking to those saints as though they're your friends, and you know, saying your prayers to the Blessed Virgin Mary and to God, you were used to faith. You were used to caring about these sort of cosmic questions, and it all fits together in some way.
Would you want to live the eternal life of the vampire? Everybody wants a long life, but the story of the vampire is one of like eternal life, but there's a terrible trade-off for it. It's a kind of miserable life, and you need to live off the blood of others to keep up that life. Of course, the life is less miserable for your vampires than for a lot of the classic vampires.
Well, you know, I've thought a lot about that, and I think if a vampire were to come to me and say, I can make you immortal, we do exist, I think I might find the offer irresistible. What about you? I mean, do you think you would turn it down? I don't think many people really would have the strength to turn it down.
I'd want to know what the life was going to be like. No, seriously. Like, what were the rules going to be? What would I be allowed to do? Would I have to sleep in a coffin during the day? And would I, you know, would the things that I enjoy now still be enjoyable? Would there be anything to make life worth living?
Mm-hmm. I still think, even if all the answers to that were pretty bad, I don't know. The fear of death is pretty profound.
Do you worry about that a lot, Death?
No, not really.
You know, I think people worry more. Well, some people worry more about the death of the people they love than they do about their own death.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's definitely true. You know, we don't experience our own death, probably. I don't know. Who knows?
You've broken some of the vampire rules in your vampire books by allowing them to enjoy life more, to be out in non-vampire hours. And
Well, I took the conventions that were of interest to me. I mean, the sun can destroy my vampires or hurt them very badly. They don't shy away from garlic or crucifixes. They don't have any clear indication of the existence of God or absolute good and evil. They exist in a sort of existential world the way we do. They have our doubts. But that's what interested me about the myth. And I think everybody who's written about vampires has done pretty much the same thing. Bram Stoker took what he thought was of interest. Sheridan Le Fanu before him. We've all done that. We've all, I think, seen the power of that metaphorical character, that mythic character, and how wonderful it is to work with that fictionally. And then we adjust the rest according to some sort of inner logic for the book.
You know, when I read Bram Stoker's Dracula, I really started thinking that the story had a lot to do with fear of syphilis.
Could have.
Yeah.
Could
and
have.
I'm wondering how AIDS is affecting your vampires. And I ask that because I know you're continuing the vampire series.
Well, there's no logical or direct connection. I think there is a darkening of my work that's inevitable because I have lost some of my friends to AIDS. And so as you grow older and you suffer those losses and you see that kind of tragedy, your work changes. It has to change. The music becomes a little sadder. There's more, perhaps a greater sense of tragedy. I think The Witching Hour is the darkest book I've ever written, really, and the least optimistic. And I'm sure that is directly related to AIDS.
What were the vampire books and movies or related occult books and movies, horror movies, etc., that got you very interested in that sensibility?
Well, to tell you the truth, I wasn't all that interested, really. You know, before I wrote an Interview with the Vampire, I can't say that I went out of my way to watch a lot, you know, of horror movies. I loved them, and they were, I loved them as much as many people did, but they weren't a full-time obsession. But the movie I saw as a child that I never forgot was Dracula's Daughter. It was a wonderful 1930s black and white film, very subtle, very elegant, very, very seductive film about Dracula's daughter and how she deplored being a vampire and tried to escape the curse. The Bride of Frankenstein is a movie that I think is an absolute classic, one of the greatest horror movies ever made, a wonderful movie. You could watch it 15 times and it would always give you something new. And yet it's a B-movie, probably. Angel Heart is an absolutely fabulous modern horror movie that I respect deeply. But I'll tell you, I recently remembered that the first movie I ever saw as a child was Olivier's Hamlet. And the only scene I remember from it is the ghost scene. So maybe that imprinted itself on my little girl mind. I don't know. But then, of course, millions of other people saw that movie and they didn't grow up to write Interview with the Vampire. I don't know.
Right. Your books have a lot of sexual encounters in them. And in fact, you write pornography as well as writing your novels. How did you start writing pornography? And I think we could call it pornography. I mean, you'd call it pornography, right?
Oh, sure.
Right? Yeah, I mean, we don't have to be pretend that it's not that.
No, you don't have to call it erotica for me. You know, that's a prettier word maybe, but it's pornography. Actually, I don't write it anymore. I wrote three books of it.
Oh, you stopped.
Under the pen name A.N. Rocalar, and those books are being very, very well received now, but it's been some time since I wrote them, and I really accomplished there what I wanted to accomplish. I don't think I'll be doing any more. But what I did basically was write the erotica or pornography that I could never find in the bookstore, what I consider a much more playful, enjoyable, fantastical version of a sexual fantasy, a kind of theme park of S&M, so to speak. Because I think most pornography that's published is just hack work, and it's filled with a lot of gratuitous violence that people really don't want. I mean, as long as people who make pornography, whether it's films or books, as long as they have no respect for the audience and they don't really care what the audience wants, they won't really know, and there won't be anything sensitive or fine in it. And I think it's a very worthwhile genre. There's no reason for there not to be very, very fine pornography.
Does it bother you when people try to make the distinction between erotica and pornography and say, well, erotica is acceptable, but pornography is filthy and we don't like that?
I think I'm much more interested in the idea that sex is really good, that we in the 20th century have achieved something wonderful in divorcing sex from superstition and in approaching it from a psychological and ethical point of view. And I'm much more interested in the idea that pornography does not have to have redeeming social merit. Those kind of things interest me more than distinctions, like what is erotica or what is pornography. I wish more authors would write pornography. I wish the genre wasn't so neglected. And I think people want it. As I said, my pornography today is getting very, very good response, especially from women. They seem to enjoy it very much and to be glad somebody wrote it. So it's been altogether, for me, a very, very positive experience.
Even in your novels, there's an element of domination and submission. I mean, in The Witching Hour, in the first sexual encounter, there's a line about her tender, bruisable flesh excited him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think of all pornography, S&M is the pornography that people consider to be the most sick. You know, except for very violent pornography, though. There's a degree of violence, even in the most tame S&M. Were you afraid of either writing or having those kinds of fantasies, afraid that it was, that it meant that there was something wrong with you?
Oh, not at all. I mean, I think the human mind is a marvelous thing. And the thing about sadomasochism, and here I'm speaking about mild games, really, of dominance and submission between consenting people. The thing about it is that many, many millions of people have those fantasies, and they transcend sex. Men have them as well as women. Men love to imagine that they are in a voluptuous bondage and being forced to do things by beautiful women, just as women imagine that they're being overcome by a handsome pirate or a Yankee officer or whatever. People the world over enjoy that sort of thing. Not everyone, obviously. And for those who don't have those fantasies can be completely opaque. They just don't get it. They don't know what the rest of us are talking about, and that's fine. I mean, the great thing about sex is there is such a variety of types of fantasy. But the S&M fantasy is a very popular thing, and I don't think people should be frightened by having it. I think it's much more interesting to ask ourselves why. You know, why do we want that little vacation from responsibility? And I can say this after, you know, writing this material and talking to people who have responded for years, the majority of the people who respond to this are the masochists. They are not sadists. You know, they're not the genuine sadist who delights in dominating another person is a very rare thing, really. And we're talking about something completely apart from crime or violence or anything that doesn't involve consent. It's a fascinating thing that the human mind does this, and I like the idea of knowing more about that, especially knowing more about what women want and what they want to fantasize and what they want to pretend. We don't really know very much after thousands of years of what women want because women have been told so often what they should want.
Well, I think that's a lot of fear. That's the fear that some women who might have fantasies about submission have, the fear that they'd have this fantasy because of sexism in the culture that told them that they should submit. And because of that, some women might want to purge themselves from having that kind of fantasy because it seems like a remnant of a sexist culture. And I wonder if you ever went through that kind of line of thinking.
No, not at all. I mean, I think our sexual fantasies are too apart from the way we are in life. I mean, again, men...
And that it's not logical.
No, men enjoy these fantasies, and we know that very powerful men, judges, senators, lawyers, people like that, very much like to go to professional dominatrices and be dominated. So it obviously they are the opposite in daily life of what they are in their fantasy life, and I think that's often true of women. I mean, I myself am a rather strong woman. I'm not easily dominated by anyone, but I enjoy those fantasies. And I think that's often the case. There's no direct logical connection. I mean, women the world over apparently buy bodice ripper romances that are filled with S&M.
You have a series of pornographic novels that are based loosely on the Sleeping Beauty story. And it seems to me it must have been very intentional in a way to set the stories in a fairy tale kind of background because it really connects it to fantasy. It's very clear that this is fantasy, not reality that
exactly.
We're talking about.
Exactly. I wanted to give permission to enjoy. I wanted to remove it from the horrors of everyday life. I wanted to take it out of the harsh environment in which really bad things happen. I wanted it to be, like I said, the theme park of S&M.
Now, I want to ask, because everybody grows up with a Sleeping Beauty story, right? And did this seem like a perfect fairy tale for you to write about submission and domination? I mean, here's this woman, she's been asleep for 100 years, and then she's been lying passively for 100 years. The beautiful prince, the handsome prince, mm-hmm. comes along, kisses her, and of course, in your story, then she's kind of ravaged, ravished right away, and becomes the prince's pleasure slave. Of course, mm-hmm. we never get that far in the fairy tale.
No,
but did it seem like a fairy tale that was kind of asking to be a story about submission?
Yeah, I thought it was perfect. But again, I don't think these things out logically. I just sort of started typing away, and that's what happened.
Well, did you read things like that into stories when you were growing up? Did you just
No, not really. But a lot of my writing today is taking those old motifs and changing them, you know, reinventing them. I mean, I did the same thing in a novel called The Mummy. Instead of the mummy staggering through the novel, strangling people, dripping bandages and dust, my mummy gets unwrapped and he's a charmer. You know, I love to play with that kind of surprise. It's very like the Sleeping Beauty thing, the turnabout suddenly.
It seems to me a lot of people are willing to defend sexually explicit art or sexually explicit movies, but draw the line at pornography. The defense is always, this is sexually explicit, but it is not pornography. Do you think, do you feel like it's time for people to defend pornography?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think really that freedom of expression and freedom of speech and freedom in the arts is so important to us as a culture that there should be no form of censorship, really. I mean, there are always going to be certain forms of regulation within families, for example, of what the family wants to watch or read or have in its house or on its TV set, etc. But I think it's so important for the public not to involve itself with censorship, that we have to keep reexamining that question and keep defending the arts. I mean, look at this terrible controversy now about Robert Mapplethorpe. This is absurd. I mean, we in this country have real problems, and they have to do with crime and poverty and real fear in the streets of American cities. And it's got nothing to do with the photographs of Robert Mapplethorpe. So for the public to be wasting its time and energy hounding this photographer's work, I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing. So I don't talk much about redeeming social merit in my pornography because I don't believe that we should require that argument. I mean, our artists should be, and our writers on all levels, should be able to be mad men and mad women. That's the function of art. Our rock musicians should be able to sing and say what they want. That's what we want them to do. We don't want a homogenous artistic culture where everything resembles a greeting card. We need our mad men and our mad women. We need people to be offensive. We need them to be obscene. That's the way the culture works. I mean, it's only when you have that free artistic marketplace that people have the freedom to create the classics of tomorrow. That's when they can experiment and be wild and be crazy. And the test of free speech is when someone uses it to say or do or write or film or sing something that we don't like. And to me, that's terribly important.
Some of your books have a combination of straight sex, lesbian sex, gay sex in it. Do you feel kind of qualified to write about the different, sex between different sexual preferences and genders and so on?
Do I feel qualified?
Yeah, you know what I mean? Some people only want to read, only feel like it's legitimate for a woman to, for a straight woman to write straight heterosexual sex scenes, yeah.
That's absurd. Mm-hmm. With all due respect, that's absolutely absurd. That's like asking Will Shakespeare if he's qualified to write about the royal family of Denmark. I mean, you use your imagination when you write. I mean, one of the greatest books I've ever read is Anna Karenina. And it is an absolutely magnificent novel. And the women in that novel are treated with all the dignity and all the depth that the men are treated with. And it was written by a man. I mean, the imagination is what interests me. And when I'm sitting at that computer and writing my books, I go into these characters and I become them. I think the idea that we should limit ourselves to our own experience in our writing is sterile and ludicrous. I mean, what did the Bronte sisters know of the world? But thank God they wrote Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre. They gave us Heathcliff and Mr. Rochester. I mean, thank God Mary Shelley gave us the monster and Dr. Frankenstein. I mean, but what did she know about a medical student? I mean, what did she know about Dr. Frankenstein? What did she know about being a man-made monster? But she didn't let that stop her. And she gave us a really magnificent book. And this happens over and over again with fiction, and it happens over and over again with women, that they somehow go out of the confines of their lives and they have great adventures in the pages of the books they write, and I hope that keeps happening.
Your new book, The Witching Hour, was published to coincide with Halloween. I wonder, on days when you're not busy on a book tour and doing signings and everything, do you ever do anything special on a Halloween night?
I usually just trick-or-treat with my son, Christopher.
Do you dress up?
No. I wear one of my black capes. It's cold in New Orleans on Halloween. But no, I don't really. Halloween has just always been sort of a fun thing, but I don't take it terribly seriously.
One last question, and I realize this might be too personal, but has writing novels that have kind of explicit sex in it changed your sex life?
Actually, I don't think so. I really don't. You know, I've been married to the same man for almost 30 years and very, very happily married. I think ours is a great love affair. I can't say that it has, you know, changed it very much.
Well, Anne Rice, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Anne Rice's new book is The Witching Hour.